When Lou first asked me to speak on this topic, I thought to myself, computer nerds. Now, how would I know anything about nerds? Well, that objection quickly subsided and began to think about this topic. What I want to discuss with you today is the role of technology in changing public attitudes towards government. And as the title of the talk suggests, the future looks pretty good. As people come to depend more and more on computers and information technology, people are becoming increasingly concerned about government intrusions into their lives. Now, I'm not claiming that technology is a primary cause of social change. Okay, no, the primary cause of social change is ideas, such as the ideas that you're supporting by being here today. But technology can have a significant influence. Now, my particular focus is on computer nerds, since they are at the forefront of these new technologies. As it turns out, the dominant political philosophy of the internet community is classical liberalism or libertarianism. Now, you notice that I'm using the politically correct term community, as in the African-American community or the gay and lesbian community, or the community of nations, each of which has its self-appointed spokesperson, and I'm appointing myself as the spokesperson for the internet community. Now, many of you are undoubtedly and justifiably wary of portentous pronouncements about the meaning of the internet and the information revolution. You might be expecting the sort of silly futurism you get from people like George Gilder or Alvin Toffler, or somebody who's way out there like Newt Gingrich. Indeed, many pundits tell us that the internet is going to bring about a fundamental transformation of human society. The physical world will become increasingly unimportant as we all enter a virtual reality of unlimited potential. Other writers argue that computer technology will bring an end to scarcity through nanotechnology, which can build things at the atomic level. These are the same kinds of people who arrange to have their bodies frozen until the year 2500. Now, I'm not going to give you one of those speeches, and I promise I will not use the prefix cyber a single time, as in cyber libertarians or cyber Misesians. No, what I'm going to try to do instead is describe the political and social views of computer folk and explain why they think that way. What exactly do computer nerds think about the state and state intervention? Well, it's quite commonplace to observe today that the internet community is a source of decidedly libertarian sentiment. Let me give you a few examples. Forbes ran a cover story in September about net libertarianism, calling it, quote, the central axis of political discussion online. Wired magazine's John Katz writes about the internet community's, quote, ingrained libertarianism, its wholehearted commitment to political and economic freedom, and its fierce opposition to constraints on individual expression. Even the New York Times has written on, quote, the free market libertarian bent of the architects of the high-tech economy, referring to people like the maverick entrepreneur T.J. Rogers of Cypress Semiconductor. The libertarian computer scientist Barry Fagan calls libertarianism, quote, the descriptive political philosophy of the digital age. It's clear, then, that people in the computer industry largely view the government as an intruder, as an interloper, interfering in areas in which it has little knowledge, let alone justification. Why do they feel that way? Why do computer nerds think this way about the state and state intervention? Let me suggest a few reasons. The first is fear of censorship and awareness of the potential for censorship. One example of this is the huge spontaneous groundswell of opposition for the Communications Decency Act, the CDA, which was defeated in June of 1996. Those of you who surf the web may have noticed the last year and a half an increasing number of websites that display this blue ribbon on the front on their homepage. That supposedly shows your solidarity for opposition to the CDA. There's amazing support in the internet community for the right to encrypt information, the right to encode information to protect it from third parties. in particular what's called strong encryption. And I should add the right to export software that performs encryption across national borders. Interestingly, there's a pro-strong encryption group called Americans for Computer Privacy, and this group has recently hired the Malibu public relations firm Goddard Clausen, and this is the firm that produced the Harry and Louise ads that helped defeat the Clinton healthcare plan. So there's going to be much more public awareness of some of these encryption issues. Incidentally, there was a feature on CNN Headline News this morning, I don't know if any of you saw it, about Hewlett-Packard being given the right, being granted by the administration the right to export a certain kind of encryption technology to a few countries, about five countries, including Britain. But the caveat is this technology is designed so that there's what they call a backdoor, a secret key, where government officials can unencrypt or decode the data if they need to. Now, I do want to say that computer nerds are not completely consistent on these kinds of issues. In general, they tend to be more tolerant of restrictions on commercial speech, advertising, for example, on websites. In general, many computer folks decry the increased commercialization of the net. Many of them tend to support so-called anti-spamming laws, laws that would prohibit the sending of unsolicited email. Of course, a potential danger of this is that any anti-spamming law would have to be a federal, nationwide anti-spamming law and not a state anti-spamming law. There was a group just a couple of weeks ago there was a mock trial to see how a state anti-spamming law would work, and it turned out it wouldn't work very well because, of course, email addresses aren't necessarily tied to specific physical locations. Okay, so a state would not have the jurisdiction to prosecute the sender of so-called spam or commercial email unless that sender resided in the same state. And the bottom line is that many of the so-called free speech advocates on the net have more the ACLU's definition of free speech than what we would consider to be free speech. In other words, their free speech means the right to communicate pornography, but not to communicate commercial information, okay, not to try to sell goods and services. Now, more important, more important reason, which Lou alluded to last night, why computer nerds tend to fear the government is because they have a unique understanding of what it's like to operate in a largely unregulated environment. Okay? They're used to communicating in an unregulated environment, the so-called chat rooms and discussion groups, Usenet groups, where there's a considerable amount of sort of community self-policing through ostracism, refusing to deal with people who don't obey the rules of the community. There's relative freedom of association in those kinds of groups. But even more important than that, computer nerds are used to dealing with electronic commerce. Okay, they understand how to buy and sell goods and services without any regulation, without any taxation, without any government interference at all. Now, by the way, this is another reason to be very cautious about any kind of national sales tax plan to replace the income tax, because a national sales tax would seriously cripple the booming catalog and online commerce markets. Now, as Lou mentioned last night, and you may have read about this week, there are several internet sales tax proposals being tossed around. One is this proposal by the National Governors Association, to which Lou referred, to support uniform state and local sales taxes on electronic commerce. Now, the reason the governors group is doing this is because they're trying to head off some congressional legislation that's being debated, the so-called Internet Tax Freedom Act, supported by Representative Chris Cox of California and Ron Wyden of Oregon, which would bar states and localities from passing any internet taxes until at least the year 2004. Now, these state and local policymakers worry that the Tax Freedom Act or the Cox-Wyden bill would drain their coffers of revenues as more and more commerce moves online, okay, and takes place between states. Now, to his credit, if you want to call it that, the president has so far announced that he supports the Internet Tax Freedom Act. In fact, on Thursday, he made a pronouncement that he opposed the governor's proposal. But if you think about it, you can be assured that something in mind. Okay, and it's not tax freedom. There was an article in yesterday's USA Today discussing Clinton's pronouncement, and the author of the article correctly observed, quote, supporters say the Internet Tax Freedom Act will keep state and local governments from burying the Internet in taxes before policymakers can agree on a fair way to tax electronic commerce. Okay, so you don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg right at the beginning. You want to let the process get going, and then you figure out the, quote, fair way to tax and regulate it. Internet commerce is a really fascinating area because it's a perfect example, as Lou mentioned last night, of how an unregulated market works. Okay, what happens when thousands of buyers and sellers get together and through a series of voluntary transactions exchange goods and services? Couple of examples. We've recently seen the emergence of independent third-party intermediaries who help to facilitate transactions among people on the internet. For example, with the buying and selling of used computer equipment, which is a big business on the internet. There's a company called TradeDirect.com, which some of you may have seen. It's a very interesting function. What TradeDirect does is it acts as a trusted third-party intermediary to protect these kinds of exchanges. For example, suppose that I wanted to buy a used computer monitor from Jeff Tucker. Okay, I'm a little bit wary of him, so I don't want to send him the money before he sends me the monitor, right? And he doesn't want to send me the monitor before I send him the money. It's sort of a classic dilemma. So what to do? Well, TradeDirect has stepped in and offered the following services for a small fee. What TradeDirect does, once Jeff and I have agreed that we want to make this transaction, I send my money to TradeDirect, and they hold my money. Then Jeff sends the computer monitor to me, and I check it out, I inspect it, see if it meets my standards, if I want it. If I decide to keep it, then TradeDirect passes the money on to Jeff. If I decide that I don't like it, I send it back to Jeff, and when Jeff has received it, he notifies TradeDirect that he's gotten it, and they send my money back to me. They refund my money. Okay, so basically there's no risk for either of us that we might be taken advantage of in this transaction. No, there's no need for a government policing agency. Okay, there's no need for a Department of Commerce, of electronic commerce, to make sure that people don't get cheated through electronic transactions. Okay? The market takes care of that function, that governance function, perfectly well. Now, it should come as no surprise that media and government elites hate and fear the Internet and all that it represents, and the computer industry more generally, as I'll say in a moment. Now, the greatest example of this, as you all know, is the Lewinsky scandal, okay, or Interngate, whatever you want to call it, which has been a huge boost to Internet news. The story itself, as Lou mentioned last night, was first broken on the Internet by Matt Drudge, author of the great Drudge Report, an online magazine. Drudge was the first to report. Actually, what he reported was Newsweek's decision to spike the story, okay, which Newsweek then went on to report once the whole world knew about it. If you've been following, if you've been on your computer in the last 3 or 4 weeks, you know that every major news site on the internet, all the websites of the agencies, CNN, Yahoo, all of these places have special sections devoted to the scandal, which in the wonderful early days were being updated almost minute by minute. Okay, a great time waster during the day. Now the pundits are talking almost as much about the Internet's coverage of the scandal as the scandal itself. Michael Kinsley, formerly of the New Republic and the president editor of the online magazine Slate, told the LA Times that not only did the Internet make this story, but this story has made the Internet. Kinsley says, quote, "It is the Lewinsky story has done for the Internet what the Gulf War did for CNN and what the Kennedy assassination did for television in general." Elsewhere, he wrote that the scandal represents the Internet's, quote, coming of age as a media force. However, Kinsley is dead wrong about the reason for this. He claims, quote, "The internet beat TV and print to this story and ultimately forced it on them for one simple reason, lower standards." Hey, in other words, well, the respectable media were not going to run this story because they hadn't had time to check it out. They wanted to look, sift through and find all the inaccuracies and so on. Of course, the truth is very different from that. The truth is that the internet allows people from all over the world to communicate the little bits of information that they have. Hey, this is what Hayek talked about when he mentioned the knowledge of local circumstances of time and place. Okay, the establishment media, on the other hand, only report information that comes from Washington, L.A., or New York. A great example of this is the extremely hostile reaction to Ambrose Evans Pritchard's book that Lou mentioned last night, The Secret Life of Bill Clinton. In one review of the book by Newsweek's Mark Hosenball, in that review, Hosenball complained that Evans Pritchard must have, quote, "switched his BS detector off before he left the mobile lounge at Dulles Airport." Now, what he means by that, this is because Evans Pritchard actually went to Oklahoma. He went to this famous Elohim City compound in Oklahoma and interviewed people who knew about the Oklahoma City bombing, who knew about the Vince Foster suicide, and got them to reveal on the record what information they had. Now, to a reporter like Mark Hosenball, I mean, reporters like him see no need ever to leave the mobile lounge at the Dulles Airport. Right? When your primary source is Mike McCurry, why would you ever need to leave the comforts of Georgetown? Now, one thing I remember about traveling with Murray Rothbard is Murray had a passion for local news and events. Wherever he went, he always wanted a copy of the local paper, and he would read it to find out what was going on. Also, because you get information reported in small local newspapers that the establishment papers don't pick up. Now you can get this local news anywhere, delivered right to your desktop. Almost all the small local newspapers now have websites where you can search for information. Now, furthermore, the establishment media, as we know, purposefully suppress information they believe, rightly or wrongly, to be harmful to the institutions of modern society itself, by which they mean big government themselves, i.e. the mainstream media. Example, in February 1997, as reported by Evans Pritchard, ABC News had prepared a segment on Carol Howe, the BATF informant who had penetrated the white Aryan resistance in Oklahoma, and had been reporting back to her superiors plans to blow up federal buildings in Oklahoma, okay, months before the destruction of the Murrah building. At the last moment, the segment was pulled and replaced, I think, by a story on sheep in New Zealand or something like that. Now, the assistant producer of the segment, a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel named Roger Charles, he protested this decision to ABC, and he was fired immediately. His superiors left him two messages, he told Evans Pritchard. Quote, the first message was that this story would bring the country down, whatever that's supposed to mean. The second was that it would lead to the abolition of the ATF, machine guns on every corner. You know the argument. The government, quite understandably, is terrified by the internet and the prospects of uncensored access to information. No longer can the government assume that people will get their information from the official media. Thousands of people have learned the truth about the Waco incident, about the Oklahoma City bombing, about what most likely happened with the TWA-800 crash, from the internet, not from the major newspapers. And, of course, the best writing on many of these topics has been done by Evans Pritchard. And before his book came out, the easiest way to get this information was on the web. Of course, Evans Pritchard is a reporter for the London Telegraph, and unless you have access to the print version of the London Telegraph, it would be difficult to get this information. But the electronic version of the London Telegraph is available to anybody with a web browser. Now, how does the White House in particular feel about the state of affairs? Mrs. Clinton made some surprisingly candid remarks about the internet coverage of the Lewinsky scandal at a press conference on an unrelated topic a couple of Wednesdays ago. This was February 11th. Quoting Mrs. Clinton, "There are a number of serious issues without any kind of editing function or gatekeeping function." Now, I wonder who she has in mind for the editors and gatekeepers. Okay, I bet it's not any of us. She goes on, "What does it mean to have the right to defend your reputation or to respond to what someone says? There used to be this old saying that the lie can be halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. Well, today the lie can be twice around the world before the truth gets out of bed to find its boots. I mean, it is just beyond imagination what can be disseminated," she said. She continued, "I don't have any clue about what we're going to do legally, regulatory, technologically, i.e., we haven't figured it out yet, but obviously we're going to do something. But I do think we always have to have competing interests in balance. Anytime an individual or an institution or an invention leaps so far out of that balance and throws a system, whatever it might be, political, economic, technological, out of balance, you've got a problem. Because it can then lead to the oppression of people's rights, it can lead to the manipulation of information, it can lead to all kinds of bad outcomes which we have seen historically. So we're going to have to deal with that." Now, I have to admit that she speaks with some authority on the oppression of people's rights, the manipulation of information, and all kinds of bad outcomes which we've seen historically. According to one reporter who covered this press conference, a reporter named Declan McCullough, who writes for a Time Warner electronic publication called the Netly News, the unnamed victim of Hillary's diatribe was Drudge and the Drudge Report. And this reporter quite insightfully added, quote, "The beauty of the internet, of the at-large internet, is that there are no gatekeepers. And that terrifies politicians because they're accustomed to a close relationship with the media." By the way, the White House has also actively encouraged Clinton aide Sidney Blumenthal to pursue a $30 million libel suit against Drudge for a story that Drudge reported a few months ago and then immediately retracted when he discovered that the story was inaccurate. Well, what are the prospects for government regulation of the internet? I'm happy to say that outright censorship of the kind favored by Hillary is not very likely, as the failure of the Communications Decency Act indicates. Although a certain amount of de facto censorship already exists. For example, in the spring of 1996, a White House official named David Lytle put pressure on Hotwired magazine to remove a link from one of its pages to a page called the Skeleton Closet site, which details skeletons in various public figures' closets, including Clinton, of course. Now, other scenarios for regulation are much more likely. The Esther Dyson, who's a well-known computer industry analyst, said just Monday of this week that she believes a great catastrophe will happen in the near future and will be blamed on the internet. Right? For example, someone will bomb a building, and it'll turn out that person used email to communicate with an accomplice. And see, this will be used as a pretext for regulating communication on the internet or for giving the FBI and the BATF the right to intercept any electronic transmission without a warrant or whatever. This is the familiar ratchet effect described very well in Bob Higgs's book, Crisis and Leviathan. There will be some crisis which will justify massive government intervention to protect us from unfettered information. An even more likely prospect is the regulation of internet service providers, the companies, like America Online, CompuServe, and so on, who provide access to the net. There's discussion now of treating them like telephone companies and having internet service providers be subject to the same regulations of the Federal Communications Commission that traditional communication services are subject to. For example, to regulate rates that internet service providers charge, forcing them to communicate to the so-called Universal Service Fund, okay, to cross-subsidize various users. There are also prospects for government intervention in the computer industry more generally, even outside the internet. Right? The Microsoft case is a perfect example of that. What the Microsoft case primarily illustrates is that government officials, and I should say government economists, really don't understand much about computers. Okay, this whole recent controversy over whether Microsoft was violating the 1994 consent decree by requiring resellers to include the Internet Explorer web browser along with Windows 95. This big debate raged among techies as to whether a browser is part of the operating system, as Microsoft claimed, or whether it's a separate application, as the government claimed. The lesson from that dispute is, who knows? Okay, we don't have, there's no unambiguous definition of what constitutes an operating system, what constitutes an applications program. This is not something that the government should decide. This is something for the marketplace to decide. The head of the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, Joel Klein, no relation, insists that the government is not trying to decide what goes into computers. However, the Justice Department's latest complaint against Microsoft included a request that Microsoft had to submit design details and descriptions to the government 30 days before the introduction of any new browser or operating system. And I want to mention that some of the chief villains in the Microsoft case, as you know, are Microsoft's competitors, okay, who have been pushing very hard for the government to attack the menace of Microsoft. People like Scott McNeely, the CEO of Sun Microsystems, and Larry Ellison, the CEO of Oracle, are villains here. And by the way, you might never guess who is the latest friend of Microsoft's competitors. This very prominent citizen wrote a fundraising letter containing the following, quote, "In the coming months, we will need to educate the public, the administration, and Congress about the dangers of a laissez-faire attitude toward Microsoft. I am personally convinced that if nothing is done now, it will become increasingly difficult to have fair competition in the years ahead. That is why we will need companies like yours to help finance and support our efforts." Do you know who said that? That was Bob Dole. Bob Dole's law firm is now representing Netscape, Sun, and other companies who are agitating for action against Microsoft. Now, finally, I want to speak just a moment or two about students. Okay, students are the most computer literate, on average, the most technologically hip of the future victims of government action. Do they share the attitudes and outlooks of these computer nerds? The answer is yes, by and large they do. Why is that? Well, one reason is simply because they are more, they have more experience with technology, more experience with computers, so they learn these free market attitudes of the internet community at an earlier age than the rest of us. But there's even more than that. Just as computer nerds have little respect for the governing elites, students also have increasingly little respect for the academic elites and the regime they serve. Why is this? Well, students increasingly recognize, as has been mentioned by both Lou and Sean, that they recognize the modern multicultural politically correct university for what it truly is, namely an embarrassment. I recently read, according to the Young Americas Foundation, every Ivy League university except Princeton now offers more courses in women's studies than in economics. And that's not true at the Mises University, I can guarantee. Students are also realizing that the traditional university as an institution is losing much of its social relevance. Okay, you've heard many pronouncements about the university being in a state of crisis, increasing costs. There's much more public scrutiny now of what goes on in public universities. A lot of cutbacks and downsizing are on the horizon. And at the same time, the quality of higher education is perceived as being in a state of constant decline. Students are increasingly dissatisfied with large classes and different instructors, poor campus facilities and safety, and so on. I was yesterday, before coming here, I was giving a talk at USC. If you've ever been to USC, you know it's not in the greatest neighborhood. It's a completely gated campus. Campuses are not safe places in most cities. What can we expect the university of the future to be like? Well, in all likelihood, it will be radically decentralized. It's already true that much of the intellectual activity, the real intellectual activity in the U.S., goes on not at the universities, But in the private sector, at think tanks and other private research organizations like the Mises Institute, that's where many scholars would much rather be, okay, where they don't have to deal with the politicized curricula and committees of the university. They don't have to attend mandatory sensitivity training seminars and so on. There's no political correctness at Mises U, as Lou mentioned last night. Furthermore, increasing numbers of students are uninterested in pursuing an education at these traditional institutions of higher learning. For example, the popularity of homeschooling is at an all-time high. Now, I should add that for all the blather from people like Al Gore about hooking up every public school classroom to the internet, which I think would be a complete waste of time, you hear very little from those people about the potentially revolutionary impact of the internet on homeschooling and other decentralized educational opportunities. It's now easier than ever for homeschooling parents to get information, to get course and curriculum information, to share ideas with other homeschooling parents than ever before through the internet. And I did a little web search and found that there are dozens and dozens of websites and mailing lists devoted to homeschooling, resources for homeschoolers. I didn't find any sites devoted to resources for public school teachers. Now, these kinds of students, the students who are homeschooled or who do get a proper education, and of course they're much brighter and more motivated than the average student, they're going to be interested in alternative forms of higher education, maybe some using the new technologies, video classes, classes over the internet, whatever. As evidence that such students are around and that they exist, you only have to consider the huge popularity of the Mises University. And I'm sure Lou would tell us that there is enough demand to hold three or four Mises universities every summer. Okay? These are the students who we're reaching and the students whom we need to continue to reach. To conclude, like the computer nerds we've discussed, these students are a great hope for us. They share the computer nerd's skepticism and frustration with the governing elites. But they do want to learn. They are interested in genuine ideas. They do want to know about liberty, its nature and origins. And that's what we must continue to teach them. Thanks to these new technologies, we have better and better opportunities to do so. Now remember, technology is not the determinant of culture. Technology is the product of culture. It is ideas that created Western civilization, the civilization that you are helping to sustain through your continued support of the Mises Institute. And for that, you deserve our heartfelt thanks.